You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Edward Said observed long ago that Islam, as viewed from here, seems to mean one simple thing, but is in fact part fiction, part ideological label, part minimal designation of a religion called Islam. Said wrote those words back in 1981, and in the intervening years, a burgeoning library has appeared purporting to help Americans better understand the complexities of the relationship with the Muslim world. But one can't escape the sensation that the more volumes that pile upon these shelves, the further away we are from actual wisdom and understanding about that relationship. So we're delighted to be able to celebrate the arrival of Rebel Music, Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture by Hashem Aidi and published by Pantheon. And The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror by Arun Khanani and published by Verso. Two books that really do clarify and elevate the discourse about Islam and the West. I hope that you will pause in the lobby on the way up, on the way out, and pick up copies of both books and insist that they be signed by the authors. Lastly, we are truly honored to have Peter Beinart here to lead the conversation. Many of you will know Peter from his stewardship of the New Republic during a particularly fruitful and creative period from 1999 to 2006. Others of you will know him as one of the most trenchant and acute observers of the relationship between the United States and the Middle East, particularly Israel, and as the celebrated distinguished author of The Crisis of Zionism. It is testimony to his extraordinary range and erudition that still others of you may know of him through his commentary on a variety of subjects in The Daily Beast, The Atlantic, for whom he now writes, New York Review of Books, Time Magazine, Haaretz, and many other publications. Speaking personally, my most forwarded journalistic article of 2013 was something Peter wrote for The Daily Beast on the deeper meaning behind the election of Bill de Blasio as mayor of New York City and its implications for national politics. Welcome, Peter, and thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Well, it's a privilege to be invited to be here with you. I am going to quickly turn things over to the panelists to make some relatively brief, roughly 5 minutes or so, opening remarks. Then I'll conduct a conversation with the three of us for a while, and then we'll turn it over to you. So without further ado, Hashem, do you want to?
Sure. Thank you all. Thank you for coming out. This is a big World Cup game playing out right now. Thank you for being here, choosing us instead. I was, you know, when I first started thinking about writing a book on Muslim youth, 4 or 5 years ago, I was thinking of writing about sort of how are Muslim youth responding to war on terror policies. When I started working with OSI, I was involved with a project based in London and Brussels called At Home in Europe, led by Nazia Hussein, which looks at sort of the situation of immigrants and Muslims, particularly Muslims in Europe, and they look at various indices. They look at discrimination, job discrimination, labor market, media coverage, and so on. And in a number of states in Western Europe and in North America, you tend to have three factors, three variables. You tend to have a hostile state policy. Right? You tend to have xenophobic movements. You tend to have negative media representation. Right? And so my thinking was, how are Muslim youth responding to this? How are Muslim communities responding to the surveillance states, to the negative media, to the rhetoric, to the xenophobic movements? And I thought that one way to get at these movements, at these youth cultures, can you hear me? No, you can't hear me? No, really? What should I do?
Something is banging the microphone.
Yeah, I think that's this, but...
Can you put it on your napkin, maybe?
All right, I'll put it on this napkin. Yeah? Better? Yeah.
You think so.
You think so in the front row. The front row thinks so, so I'll proceed. So I decided that one way to get at, to study Muslim youth culture, Muslim youth movements, was by looking at music, adopting the optic, the lens of music. why music? Requires some explanation. A number of people ask me, why would you write a book on the war on terror and the culture of war on terror, looking at music? Well, first of all, music in general, when you're looking at youth movements, social movements, particularly youth culture, youth movements, music tends to be rather important. Youth tend to use music to build community, to declare their identity, to proclaim their politics. So music is a good first cut understanding youth movements. Another reason why music is because there's a very intense hot debate taking place within Muslim communities on whether music is permissible and what kind of music is permissible. And you have centuries of opinion about this. This debate is alive and well. A few years ago, a scholar by the name of Mark Anthony Neal wrote a book where he argued, he said, if you look at the African diaspora, the identities of the African diaspora were forged on the dance floor. And I thought, in some ways, identities of the Muslim diaspora are being forged in debates in and around music. So music is a very good way to get at differences between various Muslim movements, Muslim youth cultures, liberal, conservative, Sunni, Shia, Sufi, and so on. Another reason why music is that governments have decided that music is a good way to get at, to approach Muslim youth, to reach out to Muslim youth. Governments are aware of the fact that music broadcasts ideas, broadcasts ideologies, and so there are a number of initiatives, the US, France, Germany, Britain, on how to use music for public diplomacy, for de-radicalization, music to re-socialize, to moderate, to discipline Muslim communities. A final reason on why music is music broadcast disseminates black internationalism. Music tends to broadcast black political thought, right? Given the dominance of black music in the world today. And one of the arguments I make in my book is if you look at the Muslim political landscape globally today, it tends to be dominated by conservative movements, by right-wing forces, right? So if you look at the Muslim political landscape, you have, on the far right, you have the Salafis, center right, you have the Muslim Brotherhood. If you're a liberal, you'll gravitate to some Sufi organization, some Sufi community or another. But what about the left, right? There's a vacuum, right, in terms of movements of an Islamic left. And a question that you hear often among Muslim youth activists is, why is there no Islamic left? One of the arguments that I make is that the Black Freedom Movement, the cultures of the African diaspora, the cultures of freedom of the African diaspora tend to fill that vacuum. Right? African-American Islam, in particular, tends to fill that vacuum. For youth, young Muslims who lean left, who are interested in social justice and racial justice, inequality, and empire, right? Where do you go to? Where do you gravitate to? Well, you end up gravitating often towards the Black Freedom Movement, right? And this is why music is important as well. It's because it is often through music that they hear about black internationalism, about black political thought. You know, many of us who didn't grow up in America, we first heard of Marcus Garvey through the music of Bob Marley. We first heard of Malcolm X through the music of Public Enemy. We heard about the civil rights movement through Curtis Mayfield. Right? And so, in writing about Muslim youth movements, one of the things you notice is that a number of the movements that are emerging in the US and in Europe are drawing on the Black Freedom Movement. They're drawing on the deep wells of the African diaspora. And so I've had, just as a side note, I've had this long ongoing debate with Olivier Roy, the French scholar of global Islam and so on. One of the arguments that he makes, he says, after the Cold War, with the collapse of communism and socialism, there is no more narrative of social justice. The only narrative of social justice that we have today is political Islam. So if any youth growing up in Birmingham or London or Rotterdam, if you're interested in social justice, if you're anti-globalization, if you're critical of empire, you tend to gravitate towards some Islamist movement or another, right? Richard Reed, Zacharias Moussaoui, and so on. And I respond to him and I say, actually, that's not quite true, right? First of all, this notion of global Islam or political Islam being a post-Cold War alternative is not quite accurate. Anyone modestly familiar with the history of Islam in America since the 1910s, the 1920s, you've had minorities, African Americans drawn Islamic civilization, Islamic history. But also, there's a great deal of discontent within Muslim communities today with the ideological alternatives available, right? If you're a Lefty, young, progressive Muslim, where do you go, right? And I say, actually, with the end of the Cold War, the alternative, the narrative of social justice that exists is the Black Freedom Movement, right? In all its glory, from you know, struggles of Brazil to Haiti to Harlem, the civil rights movement, but also more broadly the cultures of freedom that have been created in the African diaspora. So the book largely looks at sort of the movements that have emerged, the Black Power rights in Europe, hip hop trends. I look at various, you know, different types of music, rock, reggae, funk, samba, gnawa, Andalusi, and so on, as a way to get at these movements, right? To understand debates taking place within Muslim subcultures. What else do I have to say? I have 5 minutes, something like that? A couple of minutes?
A couple of minutes more.
In the introduction, I mentioned Aimé Césaire, the great Caribbean thinker, who said that after World War II, right? He says after World War II, Europe was devastated, ravaged, and that Europe, to reinvent itself, drew on the cultures of Black America, right? It was through jazz and the literature of James Baldwin and Richard Wright that it would Europe would reinvent and remake itself. And one of the things I argue is that the movements that are emerging in Europe today also tend to draw on the cultures of Black America, tend to draw on the cultures of the African diaspora. So this transatlantic dialogue, transatlantic cultural exchange that's interesting to me. And of course, the book is also about policy and public diplomacy. And I'll just talk very briefly about two initiatives. After 9/11, 2002, 2003, the argument was made by a number of state officials, but also outside government, the Rand Corporation, the Nixon Center, a number of NGOs and think tanks began arguing that the problem today, that the violence that we're facing from the wider Muslim world is ideological. We need a new ideology, we need an Islamic reformation, and a program was put in place to trigger an Islamic reformation, and what that meant in practice was mobilizing Sufism, long seen as more liberal or moderate, against Wahhabi Salafi ideologies. Now, this idea of Sufism as the liberal, moderate, alternative Islam as more being more compatible with modernity goes back to the 18th century. It's an old colonial idea. But it would be put in place, you know, it would be mobilized again in 2003, 2004, for 3 or 4 years. So I talk about this and how, again, music was central. Right, the idea, a number of policymakers said, okay, there's this debate taking place within Muslim communities whether music is permissible or not. And music became a shortcut way for policymakers to distinguish between moderate and radical, a lifestyle criteria, right? If the kid listens to music, they listen to hip hop, chances are they're moderate, they're not extremist, right? And so we had these initiatives of trying to, again, disseminate Sufism, broadcast Sufism, mobilize Sufi practices through music, through festivals, through concerts, and so on. Argue was largely unsuccessful, this branch, this part of the public diplomacy program. There was another analog part, and that was targeting Europe, Muslims in Europe. After, I'm almost done, one more minute. After the riots of 2005, the French riots of 2005, the National Security Council would produce a document, a study, talking about the threat posed by ethnic tensions, racial tensions, separatism in Europe. Right, arguing that the Europeans are not capable of integrating their minorities, African, West African, North African, Middle Eastern, Asian, and so on. This is leading to heightened tensions. This is leading to separatism. This is leading to sort of cities divided, fractured states. And this is a threat to the United States because it's going to weaken and balkanize our strong allies such as France. So all kinds of programs were put in place, right, to help integrate, moderate Muslims in Europe. Right. The State Department would launch programs, again, direct financial assistance, workshops, conferences, again, cultural forms of cultural initiatives, bringing young Muslims over here to the United States. And these policymakers are fully aware of the emotive power of Black music, of the attraction to the civil rights movement. So the tours, when young Muslims from Italy or Holland are brought over here, you know, they're given a tour that, you know, they meet civil rights leaders. They're taken to historically Black colleges, and it culminates with meeting President Obama, right? Sort of to show that America is, you know, unlike Europe, has been able to integrate its minorities, it's been able to integrate its Muslims. The wars that have been launched are not against Islam per se, they're against terrorism, they're against extremism, right? Muslims in America are flourishing, doing well, and so on. All kinds of initiatives, we'll talk about this later, simply to say that in Europe, the US seems to be having more success than in North Africa, Middle East, South Asia. And the reason for that is that European Muslims are not living under American-backed tyrannies. Right? They're largely free, and many young Muslim activists see their relationship to the American embassy, the embassy in Paris and Amsterdam, and so on, as a way to leverage concessions from their governments. So if you look at French opinion in general of the United States in 2006 and compare that to 2009, an astonishing turnaround, right? Even the New York Times will write a piece about how Obama is the most effective public diplomacy tool in dealing with minorities in Europe. Right? I have a lot more to say, but I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. That was great. I wasn't looking at you in a condemnatory way. I just noticed that the soccer game is actually on behind us, which creates a particular challenge, but one that we can withstand. That was great. Arun, do you want to make some comments?
Sure. Thank you all for coming, and I want to thank the fellowship program here for making it possible for me to spend a year traveling around the United States doing the research for this book. I'm going to kind of bounce off a couple of the things that Hisham's already introduced. So Hisham was talking about this challenge for young Muslims of where do you go if you want to find some kind of left-wing ideology, right? Which I think is a real question. One of the things I write about in the book is actually a trajectory of young Muslims in Britain who in the 80s and early 90s were active on the left, right, and involved in left-wing politics, but then shift during the 90s to some kind of political Islam and some kind of ideology along those lines, and why that might have happened. So there's an interesting kind of trajectory there. So this moment that Hisham also mentioned of round about 2004-2005 when the kind of narrative of the early war on terror enters a kind of crisis moment, right? We've had the kind of the failure of the Iraq war, we've had the kind of fracturing of the Atlantic Alliance, we've had terrorist attacks in European capitals, and so there's a desire to find a new way of thinking about the war on terror, right? That gets away from, if you like, the kind of neoconservative narrative, the clash of civilizations narrative, right? And I think it's in that crisis, out of that crisis, that you get the emergence of what we can call the liberal war on terror, right? Which does these things that Hisham's mentioned about trying to think about ways of using culture to reshape the identities, the ideologies among Muslims all around the world, but for the purposes of our discussion today, we're focusing on Europe and the United States, right? And whereas I think, there's been a hell of a lot of written about the neoconservatives and critiquing the clash of civilizations, that's been kind of done to death. This alternative way of thinking about the war on terror has had relatively little analysis, right? And I think it's something that both Hisham and I have been trying to think about. So the key idea here is the kind of underlying assumption is that we can divide up Muslims according to are they moderate or are they extremist, right? That's the first assumption. Second assumption is an assumption that what causes terrorism is some kind of extremist ideology, right? That comes out of Islam. It's not Islam itself, but it's some perversion of Islam. It's that kind of idea, right? And the assumption that the best way to deal with this problem is not shock and awe, but hearts and minds, right? It's about using culture and the key phrase soft power here, right? To kind of try and nudge communities to change how they look at things, right? So it's this idea of public diplomacy, right? And in the book, I look at some of the, for me, the kind of key figures in kind of developing the intellectual framework for that are people like Paul Berman, Timothy Garton Ash, and a number of others, right? And obviously part of what's going on here is a certain notion of multiculturalism, right? The idea is that we can identify something called mainstream Islam and give that particular kind of identity a form of multicultural recognition, right, within European countries, within the United States. And part of what's going on with the State Department's initiatives in Europe is actually also an attempt to export to Europe, particularly continental Europe, a certain notion of multiculturalism, right, as a formula for integration, right, which you know, which certainly is a different model from how countries like France have understood, you know, this question of integration, right? And I think one of the kind of emblematic moments in this politics is Obama's speech in Cairo in 2009, where essentially, you know, when he gives that speech, which he says is addressed to Muslims around the world, right? So it's a speech directed at the entire global Muslim population. They're being addressed as a single group, right? He's not addressing Arabs, Egyptians, he's addressing Muslims around the world. And the assumption is that, you know, he wants to break with the notion that there's a clash of civilizations. He wants to say that we respect your civilization, right? We have a kind of idea of a multicultural recognition of your civilization, right? And the idea behind that is that by doing that act of recognition, we can do this cultural move that draws in Muslims to be favorable towards the United States, and also isolate people that we're labeling as extremists, right? Now, for me, the kind of flaw in that approach is that it misunderstands what is essentially a political problem as a cultural problem, right? It assumes that somehow what's lacking for Muslims around the world is a feeling that their culture is, you know, the problem is that a culture is being disrespected, rather than that there is a political problem around things like foreign policy, right? And when you look at why in Egypt, why has that kind of style of public diplomacy not worked for the United States? It's actually because, as Hisham hinted, it's not backed up by the kinds of political changes that would give that rhetoric meaning, right? And you see, I think it's interesting to look at that same era appearing in a number of different settings within the war on terror. So if you think about in Guantanamo, we've had this situation over the last year where prisoners there have been subjected to this very brutal kind of force feeding, which is really a form of torture, but to avoid offending supposed cultural sensibilities, it's not carried out during Ramadan, during the daytime, so that you don't offend that cultural principle, right? So it's this kind of bizarre paradox of this brutality combined with this cultural recognition, right? Or again, when Bin Laden is killed and buried at sea, apparently according to some kind of Islamic ritual, right? So the issue of, like, is it legitimate for the United States to go in and kill someone in Pakistan is not really addressed, but, you know, hey, we respect your cultural practices around burial, right? It's the same kind of paradox. Now, in terms of domestic policy, you see this idea implemented in a number of ways. One of them is through these initiatives around music that Hisham has been working on. In Britain, one of the aspects of this that I've spent a lot of time looking at is something called the Preventing Violent Extremism Policy, which essentially is a very ambitious, hugely funded program that came out of the Tony Blair government and continues up to the present day. A program to use various kinds of mechanisms to try and create a kind of pro-Western mindset amongst Muslims in the United Kingdom, right? I'm using that phrase, pro-Western, drawn from the literature. It's not a concept that I would use myself. And that's done through, for example, funding community leaders and recruiting them to give a kind of narrative that is about saying, you know, we need to embrace British values, but they're never quite defined, but somehow there's some sense of allegiance to Britishness in this, and a whole kind of set of mechanisms to identify people that are considered to be extremist, and again, that's another of these hugely laden terms that we can unpack maybe at some point, and trying to isolate those people and prevent them from being able to be, you know, voices in the community, right? In the United States, we don't have anything quite like that, but we have a number of quite kind of fragmented initiatives that try and do some similar things. It's interesting if you look at the speeches of John Brennan, before he was heading the CIA, when he was a counterterrorism advisor to Obama. He gave a series of speeches where he more or less says this, you know, he gives an interpretation of what the correct meaning of Islam is and what the incorrect meaning of Islam is, right? He's attempting to give a kind of official stance on what does it mean to be a moderate Muslim, what does it mean to be an extremist Muslim, right down to getting into what would actually be theological questions about the meaning of terms like jihad and so forth, right? So it's a very interesting moment. When I was researching the book, I spent some time in Texas trying to look at how particularly law enforcement agencies, police departments, the FBI, interact with Muslim communities. And not so much around the investigative work, I do that as well, but also around the kind of relationship building, the community engagement work that they try and do, right? And one of the key things that comes out when you look at that is there is this same sense of attempts to build partnerships with community leaders who are considered to be moderate Muslims because of a certain narrative of Americanness, right? And then trying to isolate and to some extent demonize people who don't sign up to that notion of Americanness. And paradoxically, you know, often what Americanness means is not what it would actually mean according to the Constitution. So one of the notions of Americanness that gets invoked in this is a notion that being American means you don't talk about certain subjects, right? You don't talk about Iraq, you don't talk about Afghanistan, you wave the flag and you kind of keep quiet about government policies that you might otherwise be critical of, right? In Minnesota, where I spent some time as well, again, you see this very clearly with programs that are being run by police departments to engage with young Somali Americans there, funded by the Department of Justice. And those programs, again, have this notion of we want to promote integration. Right, and what does integration mean? It means don't talk about what's happening in Somalia. It means don't talk about U.S. foreign policy in relation to East Africa. Right. So the notion of integration here is actually very political. Right. It's not just about it's actually not defined by the kind of basic civil rights and freedoms that you might expect. So. You have a kind of paradox here where both in Europe and in the United States, liberal states which otherwise kind of proclaim a secular separation between church and state, in inverted commas, are actually advancing a certain interpretation of Islam, right, as the acceptable way to be Muslim, right? So you have government officials becoming what one scholar calls de facto theologians, right? Implicitly approving particular interpretations of religion over others, right? And at the same time, you see on both sides of the Atlantic efforts to suppress the freedom of expression of those whose interpretation of Islam is deemed to be incorrect, right? And you see systematic surveillance of every aspect of Muslim life in order to try and distinguish and identify those who are moderate and those who are extremists as part of this broader thinking, right? Now, one or two more minutes. Okay. So and I think more broadly, in order to understand the place of Muslims within Europe and in the United States, I think we have to look at how something you might call Muslimness has been racialized, right, to use a slightly academic phrase. So, so you usually get this objection that and if you think about racism as a concept that might be relevant here, you usually get this objection that Muslims are not a race. But actually, since all racisms are socially and politically constructed, rather than resting on the reality of any kind of biological race, it's perfectly possible for cultural markers associated with being Muslim, whether that's things like forms of dress or so forth, to be turned into racial signifiers, right? So if you think about anti-Semitism in the 19th century, what anti-Semitism is doing is it's turning people who share a religion into a race, right? And we've seen something very similar with Islamophobia in recent years. Think about the history of racism in Europe. It always has this kind of double aspect, this kind of internal inconsistency. So, kind of immigrants coming from outside Europe into Britain. are always, you know, accused of keeping themselves to themselves and not really wanting to mix, but at the same time kind of secretly infiltrating the mainstream of society, right? It's always that kind of paradoxical double aspect to it. Or, you know, immigrants are always really lazy and don't really want to work, but at the same time they're stealing our jobs, right? But what's unique about anti-Semitism, I think, historically until recently, is that kind of inconsistency is arranged in a way so that Jews are seen by anti-Semites as both this kind of subclass that's kind of corrupting society from below, but also this kind of secret elite that secretly manipulates the world through some kind of Jewish conspiracy, right? That's historically what's been unique about anti-Semitism. It's had that idea of a kind of powerful secret conspiracy ruling the world, actually, right? What we've seen with Islamophobia is the first time that kind of same structure of racism is now being applied to another group, right? So Muslims are seen as, you know, this subclass, this group that is backward and so forth and corrupting society from below, but also Muslims are secretly running the White House because Obama is a closet Muslim. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood has infiltrated all aspects of the government. In Europe, there's this thing called the Eurabia conspiracy theory, which is the idea that the European Union is secretly a plot to enable the Arab colonization of Europe and so forth, right? So again, these tropes that have come from anti-Semitism, we now find them in Islamophobia as well. When I was in Texas doing some research in a place called Katy in Houston, I went to a restaurant there, and on the wall of this restaurant you see a poster of a lynching. Right, it's one of those famous photographs of a lynching taking place maybe 100 years ago, a body hanging from a tree, a group of people standing, looking at the body, looking quite pleased with themselves. But where you'd see normally in the original photo the face of a black man, you see instead a kind of stereotypical image of an Arab, right? And then the caption that's been written on the bottom of the poster is, "Let's play cowboys and Iranians," right? So it's obviously a kind of shocking image, and obviously, for the purposes of these people, there's no distinction between Arabs and Iranians, right? But it's obviously a shocking image, but what's very striking for me about that image is the way in which it has all these different layers of the kind of racial history of the United States captured within it, right? So you have, with the phrase, "let's play cowboys and Iranians," you have a kind of implicit reference to the genocide of Native Americans. You obviously have the reference to lynching and Jim Crow segregation in the South. And then, as it were, the third layer on top of that history is Islamophobia. And so I think the image kind of captures that way in which racism works in the United States, where kind of, new layers being added onto this longer history, right? And I think that's, I think it's helpful for us to understand this particular kind of demonization that we have at the moment within that longer history, both of anti-Semitism and other forms of racism.
Well, this is really fascinating stuff, there's so much to talk about in terms of the way in which ideas about religion and race get blurred as templates that come from American or European history are used to kind of try to understand this new reality. The end of what you described reminded me of a phrase that I once saw in the New York Times, where an American general was talking about the difficulties the U.S. was facing in Afghanistan, and he said, "We control Kabul, but outside of Kabul, it's Indian country," you know, right? Which is a kind of an old phrase in America, basically meaning a lawless area where the government has control. But it reminds you of what people like Walter Russell Mead have argued, which is that America's conflicts with the non-Western world, the template of America's kind of history of wars against Native Americans in the 19th century tends to create templates that reassert themselves. I guess, Hisham, I wanted to start with you, and then Aaron, you can jump in on this or not. With this, with your idea of your response to Olivier Roy, that there is another resistance to Americanization, globalization. It's not the resistance of Islamism, but it's the resistance of a left, which is drawing on narratives of resistance that come from African diasporas. What really fascinates me about that is then the question of whether we should consider that a religious left or not. Is this, you're talking about obviously African-American diasporas that may have traditions that may have maybe Christian or maybe secular that we in the U.S. don't tend to think about them in religion. And so I guess the question is, in this other kind of resistance that you associate with the left, especially because you also mentioned this fascinating theological question about the degree to which music is legitimate religiously, tell me, to what degree are one talking about that thing that you often hear talked about in Christian and even Jewish circles, which is a religious left that people are looking for, or what degree does it not make sense to think about it as religious?
Well, there are, you know, there are movements that can be described as a religious left. If you look at, and I was saying earlier, there is no leftist Muslim movement that you can belong to. There are leaders that you can gravitate towards. There's Fareed Izzak, a theologian in South Africa. There's Hassan Hanafi in Cairo. There's Tariq Ramadan, who's one of the biggest voices in European Islam. And Tariq Ramadan in particular is deeply inspired by the African-American experience, right? When he talks, when you hear him lecture, he talks about his father's relationship to Malcolm X and how as a five-year-old he sat on Malcolm's knee and the baraka that came from that, the grace. So you have that. You do have certain religious movements that are deeply influenced by African-American Islam. And I talk about this in the book, sort of the influence of not only Sunni African-American Islam, but also sort of fringe quasi-Muslim groups like Nation of Islam, which now has a branch in London and Paris. Groups like the Five Percenters and so on. Yet at the same time, there's also secular influence. One of the movements I talk about is called the decolonial movement. Right? So after France passed its law banning the veils and wearing the headscarf in public and in public institutions, a movement emerged called the decolonial movement that's sort of took a page from the Black Power movement. Right? And their argument is that the major Muslim organizations in Europe tend to be liberal integrationists. They speak a language of colorblindness. They don't talk about race, right? We're going to do to them what Stokely Carmichael did to mainstream civil rights leaders in the United States. So you've got this movement that has branches now in France and Holland and England and elsewhere that makes an argument that is drawing on not just Black Power movement, but they're deeply influenced by critical race theorists, American critical race theorists. They quote Kimberly Crenshaw. They quote Robin Kelly. It's really quite extraordinary, right? And what they're doing overlaps to a certain extent to what the embassies are doing, because the embassy is trying to introduce American race discourse to Europe. They're trying to introduce ideas such as policies of affirmative action and American racecraft in general, right? But these are groups that do not want a relationship with the embassy, but they're sort of moving in a similar direction. And that's the interplay between the integrationists and the race activists in Europe today is very interesting, right? That's something that people don't talk about much. People tend to focus on the religious separatists, the Salafis versus the liberal integrationists, but there's a new left emerging, and that is drawing, the irony is that they're very critical of American policy, U.S. foreign policy, but they're drawing on American political traditions.
And when on these tours where young European Muslims are brought to the United States to meet with civil rights leaders, right, and historically Black colleges, and then to meet with President Obama. Right. The idea from the United States seems to be that there's going to be one narrative they're going to hear about a triumphant march towards equality in the United States. But I would imagine that actually, does the U.S. realize that it's probably exposing them to very, very different narratives, some of which I would imagine are intensely critical of the United States and not very inclined to say that the United States represents a great model?
That's part of it, is that they come in, they get a range of voices, and that shows how pluralistic America mm-hmm. is, how there is freedom of expression. And it's astonishing. One wouldn't think, I mean, one of the, you know, they stop in Harlem. One of the stops is they'll come to Columbia, talk to us, then they'll go to Harlem. And often they'll meet former Black Panthers, they'll meet civil rights leaders who are now in their 70s and 80s. And it is incredible that Black culture and hip hop, right, which, you know, domestically comes under so much criticism. I mean, Black music is blamed for all kinds of social ills. Overseas, it seems as it can pay a dividend overseas, right? It can help make America safer, it can help America better liked, and it can rebrand the country, right? So the role of race and cultural diplomacy in rebranding America, Blackness is a sort of soft power, it's a source of soft power, is fascinating.
And Arun, I mean, you guys are, so much of what you're talking about is the same, and in some ways, I think also, you know, Hisham is talking maybe a little bit more about the way it's experienced by Muslims themselves, and you're talking a lot about the way in which it's being perpetrated by state power. The this question of I want you to talk a little bit more about why you think it is that the United States in 2014 responds to this problem of, jihadist Islamist terrorism, whatever you want to call it, by saying that we embrace Islam, but we're going to divide good Islam from bad Islam, right? Which tries to make a separation between cultural acceptance and putting foreign policy questions aside. Is the response? In Europe, which is considered to be where Europe is considered to be a little bit more of a secular society, different? And I also wonder if you could talk a little bit about, there are some people who have critiqued that from, I don't know whether you call it from the left or the right, who've said basically, if we stand up for any values in the Muslim world, we stand up for secularism, right? Why are we trying to find good, moderate, religious Muslims? We should basically stand up for secular people. And so I wonder how that plays itself out.
Sure. I think part of what's going on here is one of the things that happened after 9/11 is a whole load of money went into terrorism studies departments that were created in universities and think tanks that kind of provided an intellectual framework where these notions of extremism, the notion of radicalization, even words like Islamism and Salafism and so forth were kind of given developed into part of the vocabulary that could be deployed both for foreign policy and for policies aimed at Muslim citizens of the United States and Europe. And the way, so this is not something about, this is something that is across the political spectrum, right? Because it's embedded in the vocabulary that is used by liberals and conservatives to debate with each other, right? There's something that both sides in those debates tend to share in common because they use the same underlying conceptual framework that's never really taken on, right? So you have this, you have a debate that's been going on between liberals and conservatives in the United States now for more than a decade, which is the debate where someone organizes a debate around the question, is Islam a religion of peace? This is kind of ridiculous debate, and you get a whole load of conservatives saying no, Islam is essentially a religion of violence, it's unable to reconcile itself to modernity or democracy. And then you get the kind of liberal response that says Islam is a religion of peace because of this and this reason. They trade quotes from the Quran, in necessarily drawing them out of context, and actually both sides are assuming that in some way there is this thing called Islam that is defined by the original texts, and which therefore, you can therefore get some kind of textual answer to the question of Islam's analysis of violence, right? And what, what's not done is recognizing that we are, we're in a political conflict, right, with the non-state actor, and we're in a cycle of violence with that actor, right? So if we want to understand the situation here, the concept of radicalization, for example, is an interesting concept. It tries to make a claim about what causes someone to become a terrorist, right? So you have all these models of radicalization that have been developed by academics and by the FBI and so forth that try and lay out the stages that someone goes through on the way to becoming a terrorist, and then supposedly there's these kind of indicators or warning signs that someone's on that journey, and then you can use that as a basis for surveillance and so forth. And the assumption behind all these models is that some kind of Islamic ideology is driving someone down that journey, right? Well, why do we not also ask what's causing our violence on our side, right? Because we're in as much in this war as the other side is. So there must be things that have led us to be violent as much as them. So what we're doing is systematically failing to really look full on at the situation we're in, which is a situation where we're using violence as much as they are, and then face up to that and look at how we can create a situation of peace, right? But instead, we just want to kind of externalize this as a problem of someone else's culture, a problem of someone else's ideology. And obviously that's just a very convenient story for us to tell ourselves, right? Because we don't have to really look at our own policies and practices that have led up to it. Is it different in Europe? I think one of the things one of the things that I try and do in the book is not so much do a kind of comparison between Europe and the United States, but look at the ways in which ideas travel across, right? And at different times the flow is one way, other times the flow is the other way. A lot of the kind of academic thinking around terrorism that's come out of the United States has been very influential in shaping how the British government thinks about these issues. Equally, policy ideas from Britain, like the Preventing Violent Extremism policy, have been very influential in DC. So it's more about a kind of shared set of assumptions across the Atlantic, differences in terms of how those ideas are implemented due to obviously the different political histories and so forth and structures in different countries. But what's striking to me is just the kind of broad consensus of underlying shared assumptions across the Atlantic and across the political spectrum here.
And I wanted to ask you a little bit about the different alternative responses from American Muslim leaders who get engaged in a dialogue with the state in response. It seems to me what you're suggesting is that there's a kind of implicit bargain that's offered, in which basically the bargain is, don't criticize American policy, because that could radicalize your members and lead them to do dangerous things. And perhaps, although you didn't say it, I would imagine also, be willing to inform on people if you're, so be willing, you know, be part of our law enforcement efforts. So there are real dilemmas and dangers and threats and questions, but then also I imagine that there is potential for leveraging this relationship for power. Mm-hmm. If you financial resources and also just an entrepreneur could take advantage of this, and I can think of certain people on the national level who in some ways have been Muslim and non-Muslim who you could see of kind of as entrepreneurs in this environment. Sure. And so I'm wondering if you could talk about the range of responses from people who get deemed Muslim community leaders.
Mm-hmm. So I think here, there are some significant differences between the US and the UK. In the UK, because you have this very highly structured and highly funded program called Preventing Violent Extremism, which is directed at recruiting community leaders to a certain kind of politics, it's a much more systematic and organized process. You have got I think entrepreneurialism is the right word to use here. It creates a kind of what you can call a kind of, some people call it a preventing violent extremism economy, where you have different community leaders competing with each other to position themselves as the best person to deliver this particular kind of ideological program within the community. And the kind of assets that you're going to bring as a community leader is like, how trusted are you? How big is your constituency? How credible are you? So the dilemma for the community leader is, can you articulate an unpopular message while retaining your constituency?
Right? Unpopular because it's not going to be critical of state policy.
Because you are being asked to tell people who are, by and large, critical of things like the British government's involvement in the war in Iraq, to not talk about that, but to think more about, adopting this ill-defined idea of British values and so forth, right? Which is something that most young Muslims in particular find weird, essentially. Not even objectionable, but just simply weird, because their response is, I'm already British. Why do I need to change anything about myself to adopt this thing called British values? And also, why haven't I got as much right to define what British values might be as anyone else, right? Why is it being presented as this thing that is somehow being imposed on me from outside, as if I'm an outsider to this society, right? So there is a kind of it does generate this kind of entrepreneurialism and a kind of bargaining, but I think you'd be hard pushed to find the way that community engagement should work is where in exchange for this kind of community representation role that someone takes on, they get some kind of accountability from the state in as a deal there, right? So where you know, where you know, community-oriented policing, where that does actually work best, is where community leaders take on a role where they partner with the police to address real crime issues, and in response, they also hold the police accountable for civil rights issues that may be present, right? But you'd be hard-pushed to find anything like that in the counter-terrorism sphere, because counter-terrorism policy, you know, the local FBI field office is not setting counter-terrorism policy. So even if it does community engagement and gets some feedback from us and community leaders that, you know, we're concerned about the number of people in our community who are getting put on watch lists for no reason, the local field office cannot really change that. That's a policy that comes out of the DC policy process, where Muslim organisations and leaders have very little purchase. So you're doing so the kinds of deals that community leaders get are more like, you know, helping my cousin get a visa, helping my, you know, helping someone in the community get off the watch list, right? So what you're doing is you're getting individual exceptions from the kind of general pattern of civil rights abuses that manifest in state policy, right? So I think that's more what it looks like, particularly in the United States, where the community engagement does happen is actually with police departments and the FBI at the local level.
Why don't I turn it over to all of you? I'm sure we have a lot of interesting questions here. If things start to flag, I'll come back in. I think, should people come up to the microphone to ask questions?
Yes, they should come to the microphone.
Perhaps just direct your question to one or both of the panel.
I don't know to whom I would address my question. Farid Zakaria, in his latest book, mentioned that majority of Muslims, particularly young Muslims until now, believe that September 11th was done by CIA and Mossad. Do you have recent data about this, about the opinion? Because it tells volumes what is going on and why government still suspicious. And another thing, no question that answer to prejudice to Muslims supposed to be found not in Quran. In Bible you can find same cruelty, violence in Old Testament, like in Quran, maybe even more. That's not the point. I believe that major point which creates prejudice and even hostilities, what is going on inside Muslim world. When you see what going on between Sunnis and Shiites, all of them, it makes people scared. What will be done to Christians, to Jews, if they treat each other like this? To explain everything by the hardship of history, by colonization. Look at China. They have not less hardship and oppression than Muslims, but they deal with their history in different ways.
Okay, so I think the first question was, what about the question part of that I heard was about how prevalent are ideas about the idea of American or Israeli culpability in September 11th, and how should we understand that discourse? Either of you guys want to?
I mean, I'll just take it. I mean, I'm pretty skeptical about those kinds of opinion polls. I certainly haven't seen anything more recent. You know, I think you'll find that conspiracy theories about 9/11 are very widespread amongst every part of American society, at least. There's many Americans who seem to believe that it was the government doing it, and often the reason for believing that is because they think it was too clever for Arabs to pull off. So you know, there's all kinds of paradoxes around how people interpret that event. The question about where do these prejudices come from? Are they in some way rooted in a kind of fear of a real threats? You know, the language of that you're using is one in which you're you know, lumping together huge numbers of people, all kinds of different contexts, and thinking that there's something about being Muslim that might make you more threatening, right? Which is exactly what we've been trying to talk about as you know, the problematic thinking here. You know, this is something that I think has been systematically promoted through all kinds of propagandists over the last 20 or 30 years. It's something you'll find in the media quite regularly. And so the opinions you're expressing are very widespread, but they don't correspond to the reality of the situation.
Do you want to jump in?
Sure. When I was in college, Sam Huntington published his famous Clash of Civilizations argument, right? The argument is that borders are bloody between different civilizations. There's a civilizational logic inherent in these cultures that leads to violence. And I remember one of the critiques that was included in Foreign Affairs responding to him. An author, a prominent political scientist, said, you know what, you should know better. You're a brilliant student of the state, come out of the realist tradition and so on. You should know that civilizations don't shape states. States shape civilizations. Right? So many of these trends that we're seeing, ideological trends, violence, and so forth, are the product of state policy, the product of state collapse. It tends to be state. And my book is not a theoretical argument, but if there were to be a conceptual framework around it, it would be that it's states that are driving much of this, right? If you look at when do you get these cultural tensions, ideological tensions in Europe, well, you get them when Saudi Arabia, for instance, pushes back against the Arab Spring, right? So yeah, I'd look at states rather than religious scripture. And somebody mentioned, Farid Zakaria. Zakaria is an intriguing intellectual. You know, the debate you were talking about around extremism. The debate in America around extremist violence tends to be sort of two camps. On one side, you have left-leaning people, people who read The Nation, Glenn Greenwald, and so on, along with the realists, right? People who don't believe in intervening everywhere all the time. And their argument is that the extremist violence is a product of state policy. It's a response to state policy. It's blowback. The U.S. should, you know, lower its profile so as to avoid these types of attacks. On the other hand, you have liberal hawks, neoconservatives, and even liberal, it's not a liberal-conservative split, I don't think. You even have liberals in that camp who say, actually, the extremism is a product of ideology, theology, the narrative, right? And it's this side that pushes for all kinds of interventions, right? Social engineering, cultural engineering, how to disrupt the narrative. Todd Friedman wrote an article about how to disrupt the narrative. And herein lie the roots of the public diplomacy initiatives that build on the Cold War. And Zakaria is interesting because he's one of the major voices in this camp. This isn't the product. The violence we're seeing is not a product of state policy. It's a product of ideology. And you know, in the book, I talk about sort of the rise of these new Islamic left movements, right? But I could have written a chapter on the rise of the new Muslim neoconservatives. I would argue today that the biggest neoconservatives, right, the most vocal neoconservatives, tend to be Muslim, right? You're not really hearing from Marty Peretz and people like that anymore. Today, it tends to be Munal Tahawi and Irshad Manji and Farid Zakaria and so on. That's an interesting dynamic. Right? Where did that come from? Where did this school of thought come from?
But isn't that just fine? I mean, isn't that part of the problem that these are people who are actually willing to offer advice to the empire, right? I mean, they're willing to offer practical advice to the state, right? I mean, the problem that people on the far on the academic left tend to be is that since they basically believe that the American hegemon is bad, they're not particularly interested in telling it how to do a better job of being an empire. And so if you may have very, very understandable reasons for not wanting to play that role, for wanting to see you in opposition, but you can hardly complain then when that space is filled by people who actually want the empire to do various things and willing to fill that space, whether it's Fuad Ajami or Farid Zakaria or, so how do you, is there any way in which it could not be thus, I guess?
The people in the camp, in the first camp, yeah. The left-leaning, they talk to the government all the time. Rashid Khalidi talks to the State Department all the time.
Those people are much more distant from power than I think. Anyway,
yeah, but it's not because they're unwilling to do that. It's because their advice is how to dismantle an empire, not how to make it run better.
Right.
So
no, right.
They're
right.
Not going to get invited as much.
Right, 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 right.
Their prescription is don't conquer, right? That's their prescription, or else change your foreign policy. And if you talk to people about the PREVENT program in London, you know, when young Muslim, you know, Muslim community leaders go meet with government, and one of the things they prescribe is, you know, this war, what's going on, the drones and so on, the government people tell them, look, that's not going to change. Right. What else can we do for you?
Mm-hmm. Right.
What else can we do for you? Do you want schools? Do you want the community centers? Mm-hmm. That's not going to change, right? And I think policymakers are fully aware of the level of dissatisfaction with these mm-hmm. policies, mm-hmm. but it'll go away. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some price to every policy, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's we can live with it. Mm-hmm. That's yeah. But it is interesting that these Muslim kids, you know, with you know baggy pants and cornrows, have sort of suddenly emerged as a threat, right? They're seen as they can disrupt the transatlantic alliance, right? That you're getting the Pentagon and DOD and state writing reports about Muslim youth and their alienation and, you know, the kids in Birmingham and Paris and so on. So it is taken seriously, though. Mm-hmm. You know, what the kids are asking for, what the community leaders are asking for is not going to be granted.
Okay.
Hello, my name is Julia Ashcraft, and I've been a journalist and curator who's been covering the hip hop scene in Iran is serious. So I visited Iran in 2009 and published by Rolling Stone in the Middle East and New and Chess magazine. My question, I have two questions. One is for Mr. Ie, and I'd like to know, you mentioned that hip hop is seen as a sort of negative thing by some people in the United States, and that it's being promoted by the State Department to sort of promote Americanism or something abroad as a sort of soft power. My question is it possible that the real intention could have been beyond that to break the youth of those countries away from their more indigenous forms of music and instrumentation and even beats, and to help to incite some kind of backlash or Islamic backlash that could later be utilized to help destabilize the country? My question for Mr. Kundnani is that you have framed terrorism and the discussion about it very much within about Islamic terrorism. But I'd also like you to speak in the way that Islamic terrorism might be being utilized by economic terrorists to further their own agenda to help destabilize countries and make it easier for other interests to penetrate into those countries.
The hip hop and the rap. If you look at, you know, the relationship between Islam and hip hop is fascinating and dynamic. It begins in the early 70s with Afrika Bambaataa, a Bronx-based group that would start drawing on Nation of Islam teachings. Then you get a very sort of very dynamic cross-fertilizing between Islam and hip hop. Various types of Islamic movements would influence the lyrics of artists such as, you know, Gangstar, Poor Righteous Teachers, 90s artists. And so the relationship in the 90s was largely this. Once hip-hop goes global, all those references to Islam are broadcast around the world, right? So non-Muslim youth overseas, and even domestically, hear about Islam, right, through hip-hop, through Public Enemy and Poor Righteous Teachers and so on. The other side of that is that black history is transmitted around the world, the civil rights movement, black power tradition and so on, all the references are broadcast around the world through hip-hop. So we have kids from Sao Paulo to Istanbul to Karachi finding out about Malcolm X and Nation of Islam and so on through music. So it leads to all kinds of, you know, you get new identities, you get new movements, you get new subgenres of the music. You know, I talk about the music that's emerged in the favelas of Sao Paulo, sort of a mix of black power, Islam, and American hip-hop. After 9/11, the relationship becomes more political and begins to draw government scrutiny. Right? And I believe the critical episode was when John Walker Lind, remember him? Right, a young American middle class kid from Northern California, October 2001, he's found behind enemy lines in Afghanistan. Right? And they're wondering how on earth did this young American kid, middle class parents, become a Talib? Right? And so, you know, they do all kinds of studies, and policymakers conclude that when he was 12, his mother took him to see the film, the biopic, Spike Lee biopic, The Life of Malcolm X, right? After that, he read Alex Haley's autobiography, Malcolm X. Then he started listening to rap, hip-hop. And that sort of, you know, put him on the journey towards quote-unquote radicalism. After that, you start hearing policy planners talking about how, you know, for de-radicalization, we need a moderate hip-hop, and we need a moderate understanding of Malcolm. Malcolm X argues sort of emerges the patron saint of Muslim diaspora consciousness, right? And so you get embassies from Nigeria to Bangladesh doing all kinds of events, rap, and around Malcolm and Black History Month and so on, to present a moderate understanding, again, of the race struggle in America. And of course, then Obama comes to power, right? And Obama also oversees, you know, his Muslim ancestry is played up, right? So domestically it's downplayed, but overseas you have Black History Month in Cairo, the Cairo embassy, for example, you know, is about how Malcolm made Obama possible, right? It's sort of the relationship of these two, you know, these two gentlemen who have of Muslim ancestry and so on. Now, this is, you know, the point of hip hop was, you know, the idea was that we need to introduce a new discourse, right? The battle is discursive, right? The battle is about ideas and ideologies. It's not about policy, right? They'll bomb us no matter what our policy is, right? It's about ideas, and that grows out of the Cold War, right? And many of these initiatives, you know, if you're familiar with the book, it's Francis Stone Saunders, The Cultural Cold War. These initiatives build on the initiatives of the Cold War, right? But the comparison is not quite right, obviously, because during the Cold War, you're trying to liberate states under Soviet domination, right? Now the U.S. is trying to liberate populations that are living under American-backed tyrannies, right? So the frame doesn't really work. The metaphor, the Cold War metaphor doesn't really work. In Europe, it's different again.
Would you mind just being a bit more specific about the part of the question that you directed at me, because I didn't quite follow?
I'm kind of thinking as I'm going. But basically, there's been a lot of discussion about religious-based terrorism or terrorism is somehow related to a religious ideology. But I want to point out the fact that sometimes it's used to further an economic agenda by people that could be considered economic terrorists. And in fact, that may be what's occurring in some countries now. And would you like to speak to that? And that in some instances, they say they're fighting against terrorism, but they're actually trying to instigate it sometimes in order to destabilize countries and further their economic agenda.
Right. The kind of burden of my argument is that a lot of what we label as Islamic terrorism is better labeled as forms of political violence that are rooted in politics rather than culture or religion, right? If you want to really get at the roots of this, you do need to look at the political histories of of countries like Afghanistan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the political histories of US policy in the Middle East, right? And obviously, those kinds of political questions also intersect with economic questions, right? I mean, one of the factors here is obviously, you know, part of our foreign policy is driven by economics, absolutely. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. I came back on Thursday from Vienna, so I want to relay something that actually changed a little bit.
Okay, remember, this is the end of the question.
Yeah, I was just going to question this. But the thing is that what I'm going to tell you, I didn't read in the papers here. Prime Minister Erdogan has decided to come to Europe on his own invitation and to speak to the Turkish minorities in Germany, Austria, and France. Now, according to Turkish law, they are entitled to vote in the elections in August. So this was an election campaign by a head of a state going to another state to talk to the people that the host state is trying very hard to integrate. That means he actually came to interfere with the local policy of integrating the immigrants into a nation state. Most of these heads of state in the Middle East have only one thing in their hand, which is the religion. They don't have a nation state, even in states that have a tremendous history that is pre-Islamic, Iran, Egypt, even Turkey. Now, as long as secular Turkey existed, the Kemalist movement, they had a chance of becoming part of the EU. Now,
I do want you to get to the question.
No, my question is very simple. How do you relate in what you're saying to a situation that, in effect, will never create a left Muslim religious sect, or whatever you want to call it. There is no left within the religion. There is, or you take the belief, or you don't take the belief. If you take the belief, you take everything that is written in the Quran. What is written in the Quran is divisive. That means if, when you were talking about the children that become jihadists, I mean, this is very natural. If you bring them up in a religious way, unimportant what kind of music you're going to give to them, they will end up becoming jihadists. And this is a big problem in Europe today, because some of these European citizens go to Syria, come back, okay. And what?
I think we got it.
My question is very simple.
Okay.
If you take these realities and learn them from experience that the Europeans have, where these kind of things have surfaced, and in Austria, the young foreign minister...
Sir.
You don't want to hear about
that? No. But this, I still don't hear a question. I still don't hear a question.
I want you to relay to this, because I'm giving you information that you do not have.
The way these panels work is actually that you ask questions, and the people here who've written the books respond to the question. I think I have it. I think the question is you're making about the idea that people who are raised in a religious Islamic way, irrespective of music, are likely to be inclined towards terrorism. I think Hisham wanted to jump into that.
Well, let me add to this question.
One sentence.
Yeah.
A sentence can be very long.
Actually, let me say...
Excuse me, I'm hearing from this gentleman a closed mind.
I do think we have an idea of what you're getting at.
I'm reading your material. I know that you're open.
Hisham wants to respond to you, so let's give him an opportunity, right?
Now, it's not only the question of the religion, it's a question of the leadership in the countries that we are dealing with.
Got it, political leadership, got it.
What was I going to say? Remember after the Boston bombings, he mentioned jihadi, and he got me thinking. Remember after the Boston bombings, the young Tsarnaev brother, he developed a sort of a following on Facebook. And then the Daily News had a front page cover with his face, and it said jihadi, H-O-T-T-I-E. Anyway, I think I'll answer the first part of your question.
Comment.
Yeah, of your comment. Regarding Islamic left, there's a long tradition of leftist thinkers, I mean, from Ali Shariati to the contemporary. There are secularists.
So it's not a religion.
No, sir.
Now the question is over, please.
There are even liberation theologians, but the most interesting part of your question to me is when you spoke about Erdogan going to Austria, and sort of meddling, right? The idea of meddling, intervening in another country's minorities, right? One of the words I learned, the terms I learned in this project is detransnationalize, right? Is that a number of European regimes are worried about these sort of transnational attachments that Muslim youth may have, and how do you de-transnationalize them? How to create a local Islam as opposed to an embassy Islam. Now with Turkey, they generally don't have a problem. The Gulen movement was one of the preferred alternatives, right? Even for the State Department after 9/11, the Gulen movement, which you may have heard about, that now has tensions with Erdogan, was seen as the moderate alternative, right? In the 90s, in the U.S., actually starting from the 60s onwards, right? I interviewed a number of retired career diplomats, people in their 70s now, who told me that in the early 60s, right, one of the reasons we let the Muslim world think, the Salafi movement, set up offices in Europe and Washington and New York in the U.S., is we saw them as a stabilizing force, right? Salafia was seen as, they're good, they can stabilize the sort of troubled neighborhoods, they're a good response to the black radicalism, to the black power movement, and so on. So for 30 years in the U.S., you had the Salafi movement, sort of, these organizations existing. After 9/11, all of a sudden, government elites realized that, this movement is not as quietist as we saw, and we need a movement that's more compatible with America. And they would zone in on the Gulen movement, right? The Gulen movement, sort of the Turkish Sufi movement, whose leader is based in Pennsylvania. And so this movement now is the preferred alternative. So with Turkey, there tends not to be much tension. But this debate about how to detransnationalize Muslims, It used to be European leaders are worried about these kids may be drawn to some movement in Egypt or Pakistan. But now they're worried about America. They're worried about America's influence. And the debate around around American initiatives in Europe are fascinating, right? I was in Paris, I went to Sciences Po, and my colleague Al Stepin told me you should look up Riva Castoriano, who teaches there. She's sort of the expert on European Islam, and I told her I'm interested in American initiatives, efforts to integrate European Muslims. And she says our entire program was funded by the Department of Defense, right? It was funded by Minerva. Minerva is a very big program launched by Robert Gates in 2008. It's based on Kremlinology, right? It's the idea to identify terrorist threats. It's produced studies on China, but also to map moderate Muslim communities, right? Europe, North America, and it would create all kinds of partnerships, University of Arizona with Sciences Po and so on. But it would split opinion in Europe. It would divide opinion, right, between universities that wanted DOD money. You had $15 million a grant. I mean, in academia, that's pretty impressive, right? And then universities that said, no, we don't want anything to do with this. And even in the U.S., anthropologists, you'd have 1,000 anthropologists who'd sign this petition against the Project Minerva. But the debate is fascinating. On the one hand, American efforts to workshops on affirmative action, workshops on race and ethnic statistics as we have here in the U.S., the tours, conferences being sponsored, funding different magazines, funding different websites. It's similar to the Cold War initiatives, the Cultural Cold War. And the responses are fascinating, right? The responses, it's polarized, it's split opinion, right? And in France in particular, given its rather adversarial relationship with the United States, right? So on the French right, they resent these initiatives, right? They're seen as undermining French sovereignty. You're making French Muslims are seen as a fifth column. They're pro-American. Americans tend to be more religious than the French. So there's an American-French-Muslim alliance to undermine French laïcité and so on. That's on the right. On the left, you have scholars resent the imposition of American categories, American race categories, American policies. Loïc Wacom would write, a well-known French sociologist based in Berkeley, would write a book saying, stop talking about Muslim ghettos in Europe. Right? There are no ghettos in Europe. Ghettos are a thing of the past. Not every ethnic enclave, every race space is a ghetto. I mean, Europeans, for obvious reasons, are sensitive to the term ghetto. Right? So there's that on the left. And in response to the American multicultural interference, meddling, whatever you want to call it, actually François Hollande would remove the term race from the Constitution. Right? This is an American, the term race, and we're opposed to race and racism and so on. There was actually a backlash against American intervention. Having said all this, having all these elite academic opinions, the kids on the ground actually appreciate the intervention. That's the great irony, right? So the left may speak out against it, the right might speak out against it, but the kids who are in the banlieues of Paris and in Marseille and so on, they appreciate having a positive relationship with the embassy, right? I mentioned a gentleman who runs an NGO in Brussels. He said, we approach the Belgian government for financial assistance all the time. They don't give us anything. As soon as the American embassy gives us $10,000, the Belgian government will double it, for example. Another thing, my friend who runs an NGO in Wedding, Northern Berlin, he says, having a relationship with the American embassy, we know the downside, right? If you're getting money from the American embassy, you can't show up at a rally for Palestine or rally against the war in Afghanistan and so on. You'll be seen, you're an American puppet, you're a stooge. He says at the same time, however, if the American embassy labels us moderate, local authorities, local police will see us as moderate, right? So you have these 22, 23-year-old kids being cast in a very delicate diplomatic balancing act, right, into these very difficult roles of how do we accept money from the Qataris or the Americans or the French and so on, and this is unprecedented, right? I mean, there's a long tradition of the U.S. and great powers intervening in North Africa, the Middle East, South Asia to protect minorities, but intervening in Western allied states to woo their minorities, to help integrate their minorities, that's new.
I think we have one last question, and I may throw in something of my own.
Okay. Has there been any research on the large number of disaffected, alienated younger people in Europe who come from Muslim backgrounds, but many of them are already born in Europe, their parents were the immigrants, and who are so alienated from Western society, Western culture, that despite being raised in Western liberal democratic environments, they feel so disaffected that some of them have an Islam is the answer,
mentality that allows them to become jihadists. Now, obviously, not all young Muslim people in Europe are like this. And to what extent has there been research on this to try to understand the extent of this phenomenon, the approximate percentages, and what motivates some maybe lower income Muslim people? Not necessarily. I mean, sometimes these are educated people who make these decisions, and what drives them to these decisions?
I'm tempted to say chapter 2 of my book, but that's not actually quite right. You know, there's been a whole heap of research that's been done trying to reconstruct the factors that lead to someone becoming a terrorist, right, in Europe. And most of that research is done in relation to Muslims in Europe, even though actually the number of people who've died from far-right violence in Europe over the last 20 years is roughly the same as the number who've died from terrorist acts by Muslims, right? But the research is kind of limited by a number of factors, the main one being the number of cases is so small, right, that you just don't have a data set that would stand up to the usual kind of academic rigor that you would want to make these kinds of causal connections. And obviously, even for the individual cases that you have, you're really trying to read inside someone's heart and someone's mind to understand their motivation, right? And doing that on the basis of statements they might have made online or material that might have come out through the surveillance material presented in court. But it's a very flimsy kind of process to try and to find those causations. I mean, obviously, you can do certain statistical correlations, right? Where you say, what is the correlation between these people who've been involved in an act of violence and, you know, socioeconomic status and things like that. And by and large, you find very little correlations with anything.
Well, if I could just clarify, I was asking less about individual terrorists of whom there's very few. I mean, the number of actual terrorist acts is so far, please God, a small number. I think more about the large number of alienated younger people who, while not engaged in actual acts of murder per se, are empathetic, sympathetic, and form a recruiting ground to maybe go to Syria or could be recruited or at least are quietly sympathetic and supportive of those who are engaged in violence. And I think that's not a small number.
Right, and I think this is part of the problem in this field is that we always blur those distinctions between violence and non-violence, and when we use these ideas of talking about people who are radicalized as this wider pool of people, right? But I think what that actually means is very, in this literature is actually very imprecisely defined, and for me, it's very suspect as well, right? People get labelled as radicalised or extremist for all kinds of things that are nothing to do with some kind of support for violence, right? It's we're reading people's complex ideological belief system through a very simplistic lens of trying to find these kind of indicators that they're in some way sympathetic of terrorism. Well, actually, that's not the best framework to understand the kind of tapestry of ideological belief in Muslim communities, in young Muslim communities in Europe. So I think your question is exactly the question that is repeatedly asked, funded, researched, in relation to European Muslims, but I would say it's a flawed project.
Did you want to jump in on this? Otherwise, I'll close the book. So let me just throw out one last question to both of you, which is kind of going forward. One of the things that strikes me is that in the United States, since a lot of what you're writing about is American state policy, there is less political, intellectual interest in winning Muslim hearts and minds today than there was perhaps when you were writing these books. I mean, it's American foreign policy continues on, but I think you could say the thrust of American political debate has basically been because of the disillusionment of the war of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan has basically been we don't care about their hearts and minds anymore. We certainly have no prospect of changing any of that. That was way too big and ambitious, and they're probably incorrigible. And let's just send drones to basically kill the people we need to kill, and other than that, try to forget about it until focus on China. And I think that the rise of the intense focus on the Sunni Shia divide, I think, has become as a greater focus of American interest, has not been a dialogue in which Americans really see themselves as actors who can have as much of an effect as a few years ago when people like Paul Berman and lots of other people had very ambitious and I think optimistic ideas about how American power, hard and soft power, could remake the large swaths of the Muslim world. So it's also interestingly, it strikes me as that on the right, there's been, even as we've moved, that there's the focus on the threat domestically in the United States of Sharia law has only grown and grown, even as we move further away from September 11th. So I just wondered if maybe I could ask you guys to close a little bit by talking about what you think the future of these state efforts by the United States and Western European governments are vis-a-vis Muslim communities and the dynamic nature of the response to that.
Look, I think we're at a moment, one of the things I argue is that the moment that we're going through today is comparable, the moment today where with the emergence of these Muslim ghettos in Europe, right, with these disaffected populations in Europe, populations that are not sort of Muslim communities, young Muslims that are not politically incorporated. I see this as comparable to what was going on in the States about 100 years ago, in the US a century ago, with the emergence of the African-American ghetto, right? And back then you had a situation, you had African-Americans landing in northern cities, product of the Great Migration, and there's a sense of global black besiegement. Right? You have Jim Crow in the South, you have riots in the North, you have, Africa is colonized. And then you get all kinds of movements emerging, and the state has to respond, right? And you're seeing something like that in Europe, right? You're getting a population that's very European, that speaks French and German and Dutch and so on, but that is still alienated from state institutions and that is worried about the global Muslim predicament. Where do you go? Some people will go, will leave the country, go to Turkey, go to Pakistan. I'm more interested in the movement westward. Right? People who come to America to immerse themselves in black history. People who go to Brazil, who go to South America, In the book I talk about how, in general, in terms of the encounter between Islam and the West, Western Europe and America, you tend to have surveillance states, xenophobic movements, negative media representation. Latin America is quite different. There's none of that. There's very little of that. Right? So you're also seeing movement, an interest in Latin America and in the history of Muslim slaves in Latin America. So I think this question will continue to be an important question, right? I think the Obama administration pulled back from all the social and cultural engineering of the Bush administration, understandably so. It wasn't working. But last summer, Congress reformed the Smith-Mundt Act, which was the anti-propaganda law, which is a law that passed in 1948 that prohibits the Voice of America and other BBG-owned radio outlets, sort of like Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, that broadcast overseas, right, Al-Hurra, for example, are prohibited by law, by the Smith-Mundt Act, from channeling, directing their propaganda at American communities, right? That was amended last summer in order to allow for Voice of America to broadcast in Somali to Minneapolis, right? So, I mean, this is still ongoing. There are these efforts in last summer as well. The State Department created an Office for Religious Engagement, which is, again, about identifying moderate versus immoderate and so on. Also, after the Wingate attack in Kenya, you remember the Wingate Mall in Nairobi last October, right? U.S. and Turkey came together and created a global fund for community engagement and resilience, right? So that the whole business of promoting Sufism as a liberal alternative and so on sort of was put on a back burner when Obama came to power. Let's deal with the movements that we have, Muslim Brotherhood and so on. They have the capacity to control the streets and so on. But now it's coming back again, right? Partly in response to Sunni-Shia conflict, partly in response to Arab revolts and so on. So I think we'll be seeing this making a comeback. The pendulum will swing back. We'll swing back towards the social engineering again.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And I think a lot of that energy is happening in relation to social media, right? So, you know, whereas a few years ago it might have been through hip-hop or through some of these other kinds of intervention, now social media is being seen as the space where, you know, where these interventions can be done most productively. The State Department has had a whole set of initiatives around, you know, trying to use social media as a way to seed youth movements that that can kind of advance particular cultural or political agendas in different parts of the world, in particular in the Middle East. You see the same things being organized in relation to Muslims within the United States, right? So, you know, there are different government initiatives. You know, just mentioned the Somali American communities in Minnesota. You know, there's all kinds of initiatives that are being run by Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security to try and again do these kind of cultural interventions with those communities through social media, right? So I think that's the kind of trend that we're seeing in relation to where this stuff goes over the coming years. I think the point that you made about how the fear mongering around the idea that Sharia law is about to take over America and all that kind of stuff, that the legislation that's been passed in quite a few states around the US to ban Sharia law, how that actually gets going, you know, pretty much a decade after 9/11, it seems to get more support, in the last few years compared to that immediate moment after 9/11, is precisely points to the way in which this is not a kind of spontaneous reaction to this traumatic moment of 9/11, but it's something that's organized politically, it comes from a different place. So I think that that kind of tactic of mounting these kind of conspiracy theories and these attempts to demonize people from the far right, you know, is always going to be there over the next few years as a tactic that we'll see mobilized. It tends to come about around election time. So, you know, we saw it around the 2008 election, 2010 election particularly. We saw a whole load of money going into these kinds of campaigns, and partly because it was a way of trying to subtly demonize Obama without doing that in an explicit racial way. I think these are kind of strategies that we'll see being around for a while.
Thank you, and why don't I turn to you?
Thank you all for coming here today. This was a fascinating conversation, and please join me in expressing our gratitude to Shem Aidi and Arun Kanani for their contributions, and to our moderator, Peter Beinart. Thank you all. I don't forget that the authors will be signing copies of their books.